Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the film. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to submit your question immediately. And we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about fly fishing the film. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Gary, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have tonight. So for our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, you can go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Gary's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gary Borger's new book, Fishing the Film, courtesy of Gary Borger. So thanks to Gary, we're going to be giving that away tonight, and here's how you can win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question is going to be something that Gary and I talk about during the show. So you're going to have to submit that in that text box on our homepage, along with your name and location, and the first person to answer it correctly will win Gary's book, Fishing the Film. Our guest tonight is Gary Borger. Gary has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. And during his teaching career, he taught botany, zoology lab, natural history, photography, writing in the sciences, ecology, taxonomy, and other topics. He was presented with the Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. Gary is one of the world's foremost fly fishing educators. He has been a fly fisher since 1955, and since 1972 has taught classes and lectured internationally on all aspects of fly fishing for trout and salmon. A freelance writer and photographer and an active member of the Outdoor Writers Association of America, Gary is also Midwest Field Editor for Fly Fisherman Magazine, Editor-at-Large for the Virtual Fly Shop, and Fly Fishing Columnist for North American Fishermen. He has written five best-selling books on fly fishing, Nymphing, Naturals, Borger Color System, Designing Trout Flies, and Presentation. Gary Borger pioneered fly fishing video instruction with his release of Nymphing in 1982. Since then, he has appeared in four videos for the 3M Company and in cooperation with the Federation of Fly Fishers produced environmental video, Where the Trout Are. His video production company has produced an additional 17 internationally acclaimed videos in the Skills of Fly Fishing series. In addition, he has appeared in TV productions on ESPN, OLN, and OLN. Gary was also a consultant on Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It. He is the founding member of the Board of Governors of the Federation of Fly Fishers Fly Casting Instructor Certification Program, a member of the Order of the Jungle Cock, Trout Unlimited, United Fly Tires, Federation of Fly Fishers, and many more that we don't have time to list tonight. Gary, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. Man, that made me tired just listening to all that.
Well, you must be tired from doing all that. Gosh, that's quite a life's accomplishment.
Yeah, a little bit every year.
And then you go and write another book, and then there's more books to come after.
Oh, that's right. This is the first one in the series of 20.
20 books?
20 books covering the scope of fly fishing.
Is your wife going to still love you after this?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
She fly fishes too, see. That's good.
Good for you. Well, that's a lot of work yet ahead of you. I mean, given this book that you've just finished, you know, Fishing the Film, it's quite extensive, so I can't wait to see what else is down the road. That's exciting. Okay, well, let's get started here because we've got, as you said already, lots of questions tonight, so we want to dive right into them, but let's just start out real basic. You know, when you say fishing the film, what do you mean by fishing the film?
Well, I'm talking about fishing the film zone, meaning the surface film, obviously. And so we're talking about fishing imitations on the surface, imitations mired in the surface film, and imitations riding a few inches beneath the surface.
Okay.
A lot of people talk about the bottom zone and getting to fly down in the bottom zone. Well, there's a top zone, too. And in streams, basically, fish feed on the bottom and on the top. And most people love fishing on top because they can visually see what's happening. So this book is aimed at fishing in that film zone, not just dry fly fishing, but also emergers and also flies just underneath the surface film, too.
And that's where the confusion comes into play for many of us when there's a hatch on. Where are those fish and where are they actually feeding?
That's right. And it can be a serious confusion at times, especially if there are some taking things under the surface and some in the film and some above the film.
So you got to fish everywhere then, right?
Three different flies, you see.
That's right, yeah. Well, okay, so there's different layers there. And one thing that in your book you write about is because we've got fish close to the surface, we have to worry about what they can and cannot see, right?
That's right.
And you talk about what you call the fish's window.
Mm-hmm.
But do you want to tell us about the fish's window?
Well, the fish's window is really an object produced by refraction of light as it passes from air into water. It was described first in 1628, so it's not a new feature that somebody just come up with. But in the mid-1600s, they were experimenting extensively with optics. And a guy by the name of Wilbert von Snell described how light is refracted when it passes from one medium of optical density to another medium of optical density, as from air to water, or air to glass, or water back into air. And what he basically said was, and this is conclusively shown, that when light passes from air to water, the light bends. And it bends toward a perpendicular line that would enter the water. So it bends toward what's called the normal. What this really means to the angler is that all the light above the surface, which would be 180 degrees from horizon to horizon, is bent up and compressed into about 97 degrees. So if you were underwater looking at the surface, you would see a circular opening on the surface in which all the things outside in the 180 degrees were in that window. And you'd be able to see in front and back, to the sides, and so on. But because the light is compressed, those objects which are near the horizon line are markedly compressed and smashed and form like a rim around the edge of the window. And they're very difficult to discern what they are. In fact, they sort of blend into the edge of the window. And this is good for the fly fisher because it means that if you can stay in that rim around the edge of the window, you can be largely unseen by the fish. Unless, of course, you are choose to use some bright white clothing or fluorescent yellow or orange clothing so that you can give the fish a chance, let them see you before they cast them.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, it's called a sport, isn't it? Give them a sporting chance.
I think they've got a darn good chance already.
I think so.
So that's what you're talking about when you say hiding in the edge, right?
That's what we're talking about, hiding in the edge. Because anything basically below the 10-degree angle, 10 degrees above the surface of the water, is so strongly compressed that its detail is basically lost and it becomes just a smear at the edge of the window. So if you were out there 30 feet away and had dark green trees behind you and you were wearing dark green, you'd just be part of the smear of dark green around the edge of the window and the fish would never see you. If, on the other hand, you had on a white shirt and you were white against dark green, they could see you quite easily. Even though they couldn't make out your detail necessarily, they'd see this white blob moving around there, and that would be disturbing to them.
Right, right. It's more of a blob moving that's disturbing rather than knowing
that's
that clearly it's a man or an eagle or a hawk.
That's
or
right.
Whatever, right?
Yeah, and the fish's eye is particularly enhanced to see motion and contrast. So they would notice the contrast between the white and the green very strongly, and they would notice any motion that was making.
More like now, dark image against
the light. Yeah, dark, a light image against dark or dark against light, yep.
Yeah, yeah. So how do we know if we are hiding in that edge? Say our clothing's all good, but how do we know?
Well, if you're 30 feet away, you're basically in the edge. If you need to get closer, it's better to get down on your hands and knees and crawl and so on. And try to stay as much as you possibly can in that rim around the edge of the window.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And then when we're talking about the window, then how do riffles change that? That's pretty simple to think about in a still water situation.
Yeah. All the descriptions that you see in books describe what the window looks like in dead calm water, which basically doesn't exist as far as I'm concerned. But as soon as you get into a riffle or any kind of a ripple situation, as soon as that happens, the surface of the water, the angle of the surface now changes. It's no longer flat. It's now angled up or angled down. And that angling up or angling down of the water surface changes the way in which the light bends when it goes in. So when a fish is looking up in a riffle, what it sees instead of this nice circular window, you know, with this nice rim around it and so on, what it basically sees is a whole bunch of small windows all around the edge and a little bit of clear window right in the middle. So if you happen to be a part of that cut-up edge, fish can't really tell very much difference between you and the natural cut-up edge anyway. So you can get a lot closer to fish in riffles than you can in a stillwater situation. And lots of times I've been fishing and almost kicked a big fish right out from underneath my feet because they really don't see you very well because of that cut-up edge of the window.
Yeah, so they're seeing a lot of movement in the image anyway, so they don't see that contrast.
That's right. They see so much movement because it's not like you were looking up and saw a central window with a whole bunch of little windows around it. What you see is a central window with a whole bunch of little windows that are constantly moving and constantly changing position.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're in that cut-up edge and moving around, why, you basically don't exist as far as the fish is concerned.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good to know. So usually in the stream we can get closer than we could in still water. Or a pool of some sort.
Right, in riffle situations, and that's why a lot of anglers do well in riffles and prefer to fish riffles, because as soon as they get in a pool situation, they're much easier to see. The line makes a lot of splash on the surface. It's a lot easier to hear you. And so the fish obviously has a better chance of detecting you than he would in a riffle.
Right, right. Now, you also talked about mirror images in your book. Do you want to explain? And I hadn't run across that before until I was reading your book.
Well,
can you explain that?
Yeah, the only place that light passes through to get to the fish's eye is through this window. Now, as the fish moves, the window obviously moves with it. But all the rest of the undersurface is like a mirror. The light can't escape, basically. So if you were to look up, get in a swimming pool and look at the surface, you'd see this circular opening, which is the window. All the rest of the undersurface is like a mirror, and it would be reflecting the bottom of the pool back down to you. So somehow fish figure all this out. They're looking up there, and they see all these big rocks and stuff up there with a hole in it, and food comes into that hole, and they look down, and they see all these rocks and stuff with no hole down here. So they got to figure it out. But it could be really confusing for a while, I think.
And how is that important to us, or is it important to us?
Well, it's important to us in a way because it means that the only way they can really see you is through the window. And if you can stay down in that rim, first of all, you can stay hidden. Second of all, it means that fish will also be watching things in the mirror. They can see, for example, insects or minnows or things that are fairly close to the surface swimming along. They can see them reflected in the mirror. So they'll watch for food outside the window. In addition to that, when things are sitting on the surface or in the surface film, if they depress the film at all, they'll be visible outside of the window. So let's say a grasshopper flops onto the water 4 feet upstream from the fish's window and is floating toward the fish. The fish can see that grasshopper in the mirrored surface outside the window, and it will be able to see the grasshopper's legs and the bottom part of its body and all that. So it can lock in on that and rise, and by the time the insect gets to the edge of the window, it'll be right there to take it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great, great. Let's take a quick break here.
And, all right.
When we come back, we'll talk about rise forms, because we had some questions on rise forms. So be right back. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk-wade and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or you can call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about fly fishing the film. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Gary, and at this point in the show, I always like to ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world? I know you could maybe talk about this series of books that you're working on a little bit more, and whatever else is on your plate.
Well, actually, the fly fishing part of it itself is a little difficult because the water's so stiff on top around here right now. So basically, I'm confined to either going offshore or working on my book series, which I'm doing right now. There are 20 books in the series, as I mentioned, and they do cover the whole of fly fishing in a conceptual way, not in a strictly only how-to way. So there's how-to obviously involved in it, but there's also lots of concept built in and stories that illustrate the how-to parts of it. The first book, as you've mentioned, is Fishing the Film. The second book, which is being laid out right now, is Reading Waters. The third book is Long Flies, which concerns the development and use of streamers and bucktails and leech patterns and all sorts of other long flies. The fourth book is The Angler's Predator, and 5, 6, and 7 are going to be all on casting and mending and line manipulation. And after that, I don't remember. But they're there. I got them all listed anyway.
Well, that'll keep us busy for a while, I think.
Oh, yeah, that'll keep me busy, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and I know you're so organized and so forth. Do you have a schedule of when you are going to release one every so many months or years? Or?
Well, we're not going to try to do it every so many months. We're going to try to do 4 a year.
Okay.
And probably release, you know, a couple in the spring and a couple in the fall, because in the summertime everybody's fishing and they don't care whether books are released or not. So, you know, in the wintertime people are reading and want to get ready to go for the summer, and in the fall they're reading and, you know, just getting themselves ready for the winter season for tying and doing other kinds of things. So we'll be releasing them probably in that sequence.
Okay. Now, what's your website? Where can people keep track of when your books are coming out?
Just my name, GaryBorger.com.
Easy enough, GaryBorger.com. So, folks, you can follow up with Gary there and keep track of these books as they come out. And since most of you won't win it tonight, you'll want to for sure check into there and get a copy for yourself. So, in fact, you just debuted this at the fly fishing show in Denver, right? I mean, was that...
Yes, we did the fly fishing show in Denver, and I just finished one in Somerset, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got one in Madison, Wisconsin, then one in Pasadena, one in Pleasanton, and then one down in Baton Rouge.
Good, good. So if you're at any one of those shows, stop by, see Gary, and get your book signed. And
absolutely.
Autograph there. So, okay, well, let's dive in here some more into Rise Forms. And we've got Darren in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Says, Gary, thanks for being on the show. Will you please discuss rise forms and how each rise form may give an indication of what the fish are feeding on?
That's sure.
Well phrased.
Yeah. One of the advantages of fishing the film is that the fish actually show us some of the things that are going on and help us decipher what flies to put on. If they make what's called a bulging rise, it means they're feeding under the surface. Now, bulging rise is caused when the fish takes something under the surface and then turns and goes back down again. It displaces water upward. And if it's relatively close to the surface and a relatively large fish, when it displaces that water upward, the water will rise up to the surface and then sink back down, of course. And when it does, it leaves what looks like rings on the water. Many times when people encounter this, they immediately think it's fish rising and taking things out of the film or off the film and tie on a dry fly and fish all day and don't catch anything. It pays to watch very closely, because if you never see a nose poke out anywhere, if you just see the water sort of hump up and then rings come out, that means the fish are feeding under the surface. And so you need to put on a nymph or a pupil imitation and fish it under the surface. On the other hand, if you see noses poking out, then or splashy rises and fish jumping perhaps, then that means they're taking food either out of the surface film or off the surface film. Now, the only way you can really tell if they're taking something out of the surface film or off the film is to watch very closely at rising fish and see whether or not they actually take an adult insect or whether you never see them take an adult. a lot of times when there's hatches like the PMD hatch going on, you'll see lots of insects floating, adult insects floating on the surface, and you'll see all these rises, and of course, immediately without paying attention, tie on a dry fly and go fishless. If you watch carefully, when the fish nose pokes out and you never see it take an adult off the top, obviously it's not taking adults off the top. So it's either taking emergers in the film, or perhaps it's taking stillborns or partially emerged, you know, insects right in the surface film. And the rise form will look identical. You cannot tell the difference between the two. You just have to watch very carefully to see what's going on.
Get your binoculars out.
Right? Get your binoculars out, yeah. Or get close enough where you can actually watch the fish feeding and see the, you know, see what's happening. But a lot of anglers do carry a little monocular or a small pair of binoculars so you can actually see what's happening, especially if it's more than about 30 feet away, because it's pretty hard to see when you're taking small stuff off the top.
And when you were talking about the bulge rise, that can happen without seeing any part of the fish at all, no fin or anything. Just the,
that can happen without seeing anything.
Water.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
But a lot of times now there's a couple of other things we got to comment on relative to the rise forms when they're taking things off the surface. Most commonly what you will see is what we call a head and tail rise, where the fish simply comes up, opens its mouth, takes the insect out of the film or off the top, and then it rolls over and swims forward, and it makes usually one big wiggle with its tail, and so you can often see the tip of the tail as it comes up, and so it's called a head and tail rise. But there are other ways. When fish, especially when they're feeding on small insects, and especially when they're taking things out of the film, a lot of times they'll just barely sip it, just a delicate little tiny rise. And you can easily mistake a rise like that from a big fish thinking that it's a small one. So it pays to really watch carefully, especially thinking about insect size. If it's tiny insects and they may be feeding right in the film, a lot of times big fish will make a very small, just a dimpling rise. And you can be, like I say, you can be fooled if you're not real watchful under those circumstances.
Right, right. Now, okay, so the simple rise, as you talk about in your book, mm-hmm. is that just taking an adult off the surface, basically, right?
Yeah, and, well, it could be taking something under the surface, too. The simple rise means that the fish just allows the current to carry it back and up to the surface, and then either takes a nymph under the surface or, you know, an emerger in the film or an adult off the top, and then rolls over in the head and tail configuration and slides forward to its feeding position in preparation for feeding again. That's the classic rise that most fish do, but they can do other things. And sometimes you really get fooled because, especially in slower moving water, fish may, instead of just rising up and taking something, they may go up underneath it and follow along for a while and then take it off, moving almost straight up. That's a compound rise. And a complex rise, what they do is they come up to the surface, see the insect, turn around and follow it downstream for a ways before they take it. Now, why they do this, who knows? But the fact is that fish will do that, and you need to really pay close attention, especially if they do this in spring creeks, more than any place else. I've seen them do it in spring creeks. Because the water is relatively slow moving, and they don't need to expend much energy, you know, they can just sort of follow it along, look at it. And sometimes in places that are heavily fished, like some of the spring creeks up around Livingston, Montana, they're really heavily fished. Sometimes fish will go at 20 feet or more to see whether or not the thing drags. And if it drags, of course, they don't take it. They've been caught so many times, they're just so leery that they're not going to take the thing. I've seen fish actually in those creeks take a natural off the top, act like they were hooked, shaking their heads and rushing around a little bit. When they weren't hooked, then they went to another feeding spot and took an insect someplace else. So, yeah, really pretty weird, let me tell you.
Yeah, I'd say. Well, we've got a specific question here, so
okay.
You may have answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway for Dan. He's in Rochester, Michigan. He says, fishing the Madison River in Yellowstone National Park late June, a couple of years ago, we encountered a strong hatch right at dusk. A large pool was full of big fish, all backs and fins rise form. Foolish us, we did not use a seine. We left fishless, guessing later that they were feeding on either emergers, midge or blue-wing olive, or egg-laying layer blue-wing olive. My question is, what indications do you use that fish are feeding in the film, and once you determine that, how do you determine what they are feeding on and how to fish for them? So.
Yeah. Well, I think you got it right. Number one, when you see that head and tail rise, you know they're taking something either out of the surface film or off the top. And if you don't see a lot of stuff floating on top very specifically, then immediately suspect emergers or spinners that have fallen onto the surface and are mired in the surface film. probably the best thing to do is just get down and look at the water. You know, put your face right down there and watch for a while. Because if there are that many fish rising, it's either a really good midge hatch, especially in the evening. Midges hatch frequently in the evening and early morning. And, of course, you might have a spinner fall. If it's cold weather, I might suspect the blue-winged olive hatch, but in that case, you'd see blue-winged olives riding on the surface and be able to tell right away if that was the case.
Now, how often will you rig up with a dropper, you know, a dry and a dropper of an emerger to try?
Well, that's a really good way to explore some of these kind of opportunities. And you may see fish bulging, and you may see one occasional rise here and there, so you could put on a dry and dropper, just hang a pupa or a nymph 4 or 5 inches under the fly. You don't have to hang it down there a long ways, especially when they're up in that surface film. You don't want to hang it down a long ways. You want it to be up there in that film zone so that they see it. And that's always a good way to explore. I mean, using two flies to figure out what they're taking. Let's say you catch 5 on the pupa and only 1 on the adult. Well, you know most of the fish are feeding on the pupa, so I would just switch over and fish the pupa. And be if I see some feeding on the adults, well, so what? There's plenty more feeding on the pupa.
Yeah, exactly. Martin in Colorado, he asked about, you'd explain the 2 most common surface rises. You've already explained most of the rises. Were there any we missed, or would you say some are more common than others?
Well, I think the most common thing you're going to see, number 1, is a bulging rise when they're taking things, you know, under the surface, and then you're just going to see the head and tail rise when they take something out of the film or off the top. Those are the 2 most common that you will see.
Okay. I know on the little lake down by me here that I fish quite often, I see a lot of cruising going on.
Oh, yeah. Where
literally, you're just seeing the dorsal fin sticking out of the surface. And I'm assuming they're feeding on emergers because their mouths aren't not coming out, but half their body, it seems like, is out of the water.
Yeah, they're probably feeding just right under the surface film. And, you know, in lakes, trout cruise because the water isn't moving, they move. And if they're taking things off the top, it creates what we call a gulping effect. You know, you get that gulp, and they'll rise at a very specified distance. So let's say they're rising every 4 feet along the way, and you'll actually see their nose poke out, or you'll hear the little gulping sound if they're taking things out of the film or off the film. If it's under the film, very likely you will see a tail, or you might see a fin.
Right.
Yep, yeah, especially if the water's a little shallow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I see a lot of, and no slurping at all, you know, just tail and fin sticking out. And it makes them easy to follow and try to lead.
Oh, it does.
You can for once see where they're going.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's kind of a cool thing. Okay, anything else that we need to tell the folks about rise forms?
Well, I think let's repeat something we said before, and that is always watch very carefully because it's easy to get confused when you see rings on the water and think that it's a fish taking dry flies off the top. You got 3 choices, under the film, in the film, or on the film. And the bulging rise is under the film. The nose poking out, that's in the film, or on the film. And then you just have to sort of watch carefully to make sure you can distinguish between whether or not it's taking adults off the top or emergers. If it's a heavy hatch, I just go to the emerger first. I don't even bother with the dry fly. I just go to the emerger, fish it in the film.
There's usually more activity
on it. It's much more activity usually on the emerger than on the adults.
We have a couple of questions came in on the internet I want to catch here.
Okay.
Mark Criswell in Alabama asks, are camo pattern clothes any better than solid colors? Going back to the window.
Well, I don't really think they are. Now, Charlie Brooks used to wear camo and paint his face up like he was hunting and crawl around on his, you know, on his belly and all this kind of stuff. And he caught a lot of big fish. But I don't think it's necessary to go to that extent. I think you need to wear something that's darker, that if there's, you know, if you're fishing places where there's trees and high backgrounds and all that kind of stuff, so that you tend to blend in more with what's happening. You're going to be so smashed and so distorted in that rim around the edge of the window that whether you're camouflage or dark green or dark, you know, or gray or brown or whatever, it won't really matter.
Okay. Let's talk about some equipment, flies, and so forth.
Sure.
We have Dan in East Peoria, Illinois. He says, what kind of fly line do you recommend for dry fly fishing when the water is extremely clear and the fish easily spooked? I guess he's looking for clear or colored suggestions.
There's really only one clear floating fly line made by Monic, which works very well, especially in lake situations when it's extremely clear and the fish are real spooky. The other option, of course, is just to go to a real long leader. Instead of fishing an 8 or 9 foot leader, go to a 18 foot leader.
basically by the time your line gets close enough for them to see you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
It should be far away when it comes to the lines. And I'm assuming when you're fishing the film, you're primarily using floating lines, right?
Primarily you are. You know, occasionally, especially in lake fishing, you can get into the use of intermediate lines to fish down there anywhere from 6 inches to a foot down under the surface, especially when it's windy. Intermediate lines are smaller in diameter than floating lines, and so they cast into the wind far better than a floating line does. And if you grease them up with fly floatant, you know, just get some fly floatant on your fingers and run it along the line, it will remain in surface film quite nicely. So it sort of acts like the old silk lines. In fact, it's probably the closest line we have to an old silk line in terms of the way it performs.
Okay. Good tips there on greasing the line itself. Talk about your terminal tackle, because you have some methods that you find effective. Can you tell us about your terminal tackle and how you...
You're talking about leaders here?
Leaders, yeah.
I presume, yep.
Yeah, leaders and,
yeah.
And so forth, and greasing the line and all that.
Yep. Well, let's talk about stream fishing, first of all. The single biggest problem in stream fishing is drag, because you're throwing, you know, a line over moving water. And if any two places in that moving water are going at different speed, which they always are, then the line is going to be pulled different speeds. So if the line is lying straight across that moving water, and part of it's getting pulled at one speed, and another part's getting pulled at a different speed, the fly is not going to be able to float along like a natural floating insect, either riding on the surface or in the surface film. It's going to be dragged across the surface. Drag doesn't necessarily indicate to the fish that something's, you know, wrong with the fly. It just doesn't do what the natural does. And they're used to an insect that's just floating along without being moving over the surface, you know, like a little motorboat. So they don't take those. We have to remember that oftentimes we try to put on fish our own emotions or our own understandings. And that's just not true. The fish's IQ for a wise old brown trout is only 6. So there's not a whole lot of room in there for smarts, you know. They're not really smart. What they are is they're so locked in to the behavior of the natural. If anything behaves differently, they just don't take it. So we want our flies to float as perfectly as we can, you know, like the natural, without any drag on them at all. And, of course, the thing that causes drag most instantaneously will be the leader, because it's attached to the fly. So when George Harvey came out with his concept of a leader that's long and thin and soft, so that when you cast it, it will not lay out straight, it falls to the surface in all these S-curves, he really moved dry fly fishing, you know, a huge distance forward, because before that time, leaders were made so they would turn over perfectly straight, and you'd get drag every time. Now, with the Harvey-style leaders, the fly is able to just slide along on the surface and do whatever it does exactly like the natural does, and appears, of course, much more natural to the fish. So the trick for the Harvey-style leaders, if you just remember longer and thinner and maybe a little softer material, bingo. And you can tell when you look at your leader, if it straightens out perfectly on the surface and lays perfectly straight, hey, you need to change it a little bit. Just add some more tippet material or a little bit softer, longer butt section to it. And when it falls on the surface, if it drops in S-curves, you got it.
Now, are there any specific leaders that are manufactured with that in mind?
There really aren't, but you know what you can do is, a lot of people just like to buy tapered leaders. That's fine. But you need to understand how tapered leaders, a standard tapered leader performs, and then what you could do to modify that to turn it into a leader that's going to perform more like you want it to. So if you bought a standard trout leader that, say, it was tapered down to 4X, and you were fishing something that required 6X, I would tie on 2 or 3 feet of 6X and try it and see what it looks like. And if that's not quite enough, add a little bit more.
Okay, so that you get the lighter, thinner length out at the end.
That's where you want.
And the more you have, the less drag you're going to have, the more S-curves you're going to have.
You know, if you read a lot of the older books, you'll see, well, you know, I didn't catch him on 4X because they saw it, so I went down to 6X and they took it immediately. The size of the tip, it doesn't matter. They see them all. But when they went to 6X, it was much finer, so they didn't get as much drag as when they had 4X on. George Harvey used to fish tricos in Pennsylvania. That's a size 24 on 3X, just to prove to people that it wasn't the diameter of the leader, it was drag that was doing it. And he would catch fish one after the other, because he just used a real long piece of 3X.
So that's our nemesis, is drag, huh?
Yeah, on a scale of 1 to 10, drag's 1,000.
Yeah.
Everything else is 5 or less.
Wow. Wow.
Yep.
That says a lot right there. Okay, so longer, thinner. Make sure you're getting lots of S-curves, and that's where you want to be, both on still water and moving water.
I do it even on still water because still water really isn't still. You basically have wind blowing, and if the wind has been blowing at all within the last 48 hours, you've got surface current still moving, and you know, you got waves going on, all sorts of things happening. And it will give you much better performance on both still water and on moving water. And then you can add to that, of course, mending line and different kinds of cast that you can apply to that to help correct line position to further compensate for any kind of drag that might be occurring.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we need to take a quick break, Gary, and we'll be right back and talk a little bit about greasing the leader and see what you have to say about that. So hang in there, folks. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or you can go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com, flatstime.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Gary Borger about fly fishing the film. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, we're going to ask you about greasing the leader. Now, that's a technique that is used in a number of situations. You want to explain where that's valuable for us?
Well, one place that it's very valuable is when you're fishing a nymph or a pupa, a small nymph or pupa, just under the surface film. In fact, this is one of the oldest nymphing tactics known. It was developed by G.E.M. Skews in England at the end of the 1800s. And, of course, in those days, he was fishing with a silk line and gut leader, and he needed them to float to hold the fly up near the surface. So he would put, I don't know what they used in those days, probably bear grease of some kind. Anyway, he would grease up his leader out to within about 6 to 8 inches of the fly, making certain not to get any on the fly. And then he would wet the fly with a little saliva, and then cast it out, and then he would watch the leader. Now, the leader, the greased leader, is doing a couple things. Number one, it's suspending the fly. So, like a bobber, which is a suspension device, it suspends it in that surface food zone. Number two, it tells you things that are going on. So, it tells you whether or not the fly is in the right food lane. It tells you if the fly is dragging, because if the leader is dragging, the fly is dragging. And if the leader suddenly pauses and draws under very sharply, then you know you've either caught a stick or a piece of grass or you've got a fish. And then you just tighten up. So that greased leader tactic is an excellent one on still waters and on spring creeks where the surface is smooth. In moving water, where you have riffles and other broken water situations, you can't see the leader on the surface. So that's when I would use a dry end dropper or hang the fly under an indicator, maybe 4 or 5 inches under an indicator. Most people, when they think of dry and dropper, think of, you know, hopper and dropper with one fly 18 inches, the pupa, a nymph 18 inches under, or 24 inches underneath the hopper. But if you're fishing in the food zone up there at the top, you know, right in that film zone, you better keep the fly within 6 inches of the dry. So I tie it very close, and I just tie right under the hook bend of the dry fly. So put on something like a caddis, and then tie a short piece of tippet material right onto the hook bend. Hang your pupa imitation or your nymph imitation 4 to 6 inches underneath that and fish it. And sometimes they take the dry, and if they're taking pupa, most of the time they'll take the pupa.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I found that, you know, very effective, especially when it's, you know, dusk or dark and it's real hard going on. That's a good way to kind of cheat a little bit.
And it's a really effective technique in lake fishing, stillwater fishing.
Right.
Especially if you use a caddis, because if you can pull it over the surface a little bit, just fast enough to create a little V that you can see, it looks like a caddis running on top, so a lot of times they'll take the caddis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great, great. Okay, question from Chuck in Santa Rosa, California.
Mm-hmm.
Says, thanks for fishing the film. I liked it so much, I bought copies for two of my buddies.
Good deal, Chuck.
section on leader design convinced me to tie my own leaders this year. My questions, what is the shelf life of mono I keep at home in a cool, dry spot? What is the shelf life of mono leaders and tippet materials when stored in my vest? And what is the shelf life of fluorocarbon? And it says, thanks for all you've contributed to our sport. So that's a good question.
Yeah, it is. Most monos, if they're stored in a cool, dry place and not exposed to sunlight, will last 3 years or more. But if they're exposed to sunlight, they break down very quickly. What happens is UV light actually breaks down the plasticizer in the monofilament and becomes brittle. So if it's stored in the vest and kept out, you know, in the hot car or something like that, well, maybe it'll last a year, maybe not.
Yeah.
If it's kept out in UV light, gosh, a couple months it'd be gone.
Yeah.
So I keep all my monofilaments that I'm not using in a cool, dry place, and I've had some there for 5 or 6 years, and it's still just fine.
But when you're working out of your vest, you're taking them in and out of the light during, you know, and so,
yeah,
a lot of times I find, like you said, even at the end of the season or for sure by next season, they're no good.
Yeah, by next season. I always replace the stuff that's in my vest every year.
Right.
Most of the time, however, I got to replace it 2 or 3 times a year because, especially in the sizes that you normally use for, you know, let's say 3X down to 6X, which you're using most of the time. Gosh, a lot of times you go through 2 or 3 spools of that stuff in a year.
Right. Yeah, using it up before it goes bad, so to speak. Yeah. And then what about fluorocarbon? Does it have different characteristics?
No, fluorocarbon is pretty much the same as nylon in terms of its, you know, breakdown by UV light and so on. And we might note here, too, that fly lines also break down in UV light. They're all plastics, and they all have plasticizer in them, which causes the molecules to link together, and that plasticizer breaks down by UV light, and it gets lost with use and flexion and all that kind of stuff. So it always pays to check your fly line. If they've got cracks in them and if they feel a little stiff, time to replace them.
Right.
Which maybe we should make a note here on leaders and when it's time to replace leaders. You know, a lot of people use the same leader all season long, just keep hacking off chunks and add new pieces. That's a mistake because leaders can get brittle, too. And what you need to do when you take the leader off the reel is stretch it between your hands. Don't run it through a piece of rubber or a couple of pieces of leather or something like that. That burns the surface. What you want to do is just pull it very tight between your hands and stretch it. And then hold it in that stretched position for a few seconds, long enough to say something like, you know, now you're as straight as you can be, or now you've got a new memory or something like that. If it won't stretch out, if it won't straighten, if it remains in that sort of semi-curled up position like it came off the reel, then it's lost its plasticity and it's time to replace it.
Ah.
Yeah, so it's real easy to check them. And then I always do that, too, to check to see if there's nicks in the leader, if a knot is, you know, weak or something like that.
Right.
So just stretch them out. And if it won't stretch, just put on a new one.
On a new one. Good.
Yep.
Good. Okay, we have some questions here that came in about flies specifically. John in Great Falls, Montana says, what are the best mayfly and caddis patterns to fish in the film, especially in western tailwaters? Do you have any favorites?
Well, western tailwaters have tremendous hatches of betis. All of them do. And then some of them have good hatches of other insects that we would identify with trout waters, like PMDs and sometimes some of the, and always midges. Every tailwater is just loaded with midges, as are the spring creeks. So, you know, if I was going to be fishing midges, I'd want Griffith's gnats, which I could fish as the full-blown adult or cut it off on the bottom and fish it as an emerger. And sometimes they even cut them off top and bottom, so they float right down in the surface film. PMDs, I would fish typically either a parachute floating nymph or a wet dry fly, which is just a soft tackle tied with a pale green body, yellowy green body, and a gray soft tackle. And I would fish that dry, not wet. Because especially in the PMD hatch, there's lots and lots of cripples and stillborns, and fish will often focus on those far more than they will focus on the adults because there's so many of them, and they're so easy to catch.
Okay. Good. And I know what your answer to this question is going to be. Mike in Potomac, Maryland asks, what's the optimal size emergers for many tailwaters?
Well, that depends on the tailwater. Yeah. I'll tell you this. Basically small.
Yeah. If you can see it, it's too large.
Yeah, if you can see it, it's too big. That's right. Basically, 16s and smaller for most tailwaters most of the time. I mean, you might get on some place like the Bighorn and have a really good hatch of olive stones or something, you know, and be up there on a size 10 or 12 hook. But most of the time, the stuff you see on tailwaters, simply because the tailwaters are cold, and you've got really tremendous midge hatches, so you're down there in 16s, 18s, and 20s, and even midge, I mean, even nymphs sometimes you're fishing 22s and 24s, especially underneath the surface film or even on the bottom, which can be sort of tricky. But unless you see big insects, I would say in most tailwaters you're going to be 16s and smaller.
Okay. Sally in Manitou Springs, Colorado asks, is a CDC feather used as a merger wing the best material to use when fishing the film?
And if it's so, a great material. CDC is a fabulous material. Let's make a note here about, since CDC reminded me of something. You know, a parachute-style pattern like the Adams is an emerger-style fly. It's not a dry fly because the parachute lays on the surface film, and since the parachute is above the body, that means that the body is either in the film or under the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why parachute-style flies work so well, and most people have such great success with them. I've had people say to me, well, they don't care what it is as long as you give them a parachute Adams. I say, okay, fish a regular Adams, then, if you think an Adams is a good fly.
Right.
And they don't catch anything. Then go back to the parachute. Oh, see, all the parachute-style flies are all emerger-style flies. Now, a parachute fly tied with a CDC wing will just float like a dang cork. So they make wonderful emerger-style patterns, whether you make a loop wing with them or whether you just let the post stick straight up. You know, okay. And parachute a hackle a couple turns around it.
Otis in Reno, Nevada asks, what makes the most realistic emerger bubbles, antron or wool?
Probably a glass bead. No. Antron yawn makes a really good bubble because it reflects light more like an air bubble would than wool would. Although wool will sometimes catch air, but so will antron. A lot of times, especially if you have wool and you put a little fly floating on it, it'll catch a little bit of air bubble, and so it gives a very nice kind of reflection, too. A lot of guys do use glass beads, though, which works nicely, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We had, let's see, looking at some questions coming here on the Internet, see if they coincide with what we're talking about. Okay, here's one. Duke in Ithaca asks, last year I was fishing a creek in upstate New York during late afternoon. Fish were rising head and fin all around, but there were no bugs on the water surface. I fished the creek another hour, but no indication of a hatch. Also, fish were holding in their lanes and slowly moving to take food from just below the surface. Can you please help me? What was happening, and would it be a situation where you would fish at the film?
Well, that's one of those kind of places where I think I'd be hanging some kind of a pupa or nymph underneath a dry down 3 or 4 inches and fishing that and trying it. Usually when you don't see things on the surface, obviously it means there's something in the film or just underneath the film. And almost never do you see anything there except insects. Now I have seen, once or twice in my fishing life, I have seen scuds up there in the film floating along. You know, there's a thing called behavioral drift in which they will actually release the bottom and float. And I've seen fish feeding on those, and it was very confusing until we figured it out. But almost always, it's insects, because insects exist in such massive numbers that when they get up there in the surface film, fish will move up there. You know, you think about fish feeding in the film, that's a danger zone for fish.
Right.
The only thing that's going to get them up there is so much food that they can't resist. And so only three kinds of insects that actually hatch in the film, and that's mayflies, caddises, and midges. So, number one, you know, if there's a hatch going on, it's got to be that. Number two, if you see feeding and you really don't see anything, you might watch. It might be ants, or it might be small beetles on top, too. I've seen that go on, and it's really confusing at first because the fish are taking almost everyone that comes down, and you're not seeing a giant hatch going on, and you're going like, what is this? And then all of a sudden, you look and you see small ants on the surface. I've seen that.
Interesting. Interesting. Dan in Denver asks, when is a soft hackle fly a good choice to fish the film?
Basically all the time.
All the time?
Yeah, they're good for lots of things. And soft hackles are really good, as I mentioned earlier, if you've got a hatch going on, especially PMDs. But I've used them in Betis hatches and other hatches, too, quite effectively. Fishing them dry. Underneath the surface, they make really good representations of nymphs or pupa that are hanging underneath the surface film. The original concept behind the soft hackle was that the varied soft nature of the hackle allows them to move in any slight current at all underneath the surface, and so they give a more of a natural kind of swimming motion or life appearance than would a fly tied with stiff hackle when it's fished under the surface. So you can fish them under the surface, or you can fish them in the film, or you can actually, you know, like I say, I put floating on them and fish them right up on the top. They can be very effective that way.
Second question, he says, what's your go-to pattern for a cripple or stuck-in-the-shuck mayfly that cannot break through the surface film?
Yeah, that's the wet dry fly. And I will fish it with either without a tail, or I'll put a husk hanging out the back made of probably 12 or so strands of Antron yarn or polypropylene yarn or something like that.
Okay, okay. We need to, again, take a quick break, and we'll be right back, and we'll dig in some more and talk about some strategies and presentation tech.
All right.
All right. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and a fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call them at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about fly fishing the film. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Gary, let's see here. Any tips on, other than what you've covered so far, on tying flies for fishing in the film? Materials, you know, styles, techniques. And it sounds like you use a scissors a lot on the water, right?
Yeah, I do. I think the first thing, we've already covered it, but I think what it pays to repeat it, and that is parachute-style flies represent the insect, you know, in the process of emergence. Because the parachute sits on the film and the body will be in and under the film. So in that process, you can have parachute flies that are just representing just the nymph when it's up there getting ready to emerge. You can have with a short wing on the top, like it's just coming out. You can have like the Adams style with a long wing that looks like the adult nearly out. So you can change the patterns a lot. Now the interesting thing about this is that all of the insects that emerge at the film, that is, mayflies, caddises, and midges, all look almost exactly the same during the emergence process. So you could fish, let's say, a parachute Adams, in the appropriate size during any of those hatches and be successful. Maybe not wildly successful, but let's say you just got to the river and you didn't have any patterns that were of the right body color and so on, but you had a parachute Adams. You could stick that on if it was the right size and catch fish if they were taking midges, caddises, or mayflies, any one of those. For that reason, it's sort of got the name the Universal Emerger, and it's a really, really good fly for that.
Yeah, yeah, good, good. Okay, oh, we've got one going back to the tippet material. Duke in Ithaca, New York says, do you have a preference between fluorocarbon and monofilament tippet when fishing the film? And we didn't really cover that.
Well, typically I just use straight old mono. I don't use fluorocarbons. Some places, and most often I have seen this when I'm fishing still waters, and the sun is overhead, and the still water is dill, and the leader will cast a big shadow on the bottom. There's the place that fluorocarbon comes in, because fluorocarbon is, number one, more the refractive index of water. Closer, it's about 1.33 and water's 1. And mono's up around 1.57. So its refractive index is closer, so it looks more like water. Number two, it sinks a little bit, so it'll be under the surface and won't cast as big a shadow as mono laying up on top. That's about the only place I've ever seen that. There's debate in the literature go on and on and on about whether the tippet should sink or whether it should float when you're fishing with a dry fly. 99% of the time, I just let it float. But under very special conditions, when those fish are spooky as all get out, which they are in still waters and the sun straight up overhead, and you're casting a big shadow on the bottom with that leader, there's the kind of place that fluorocarbon really can come in handy.
Okay, let's see. We've got another one coming in here on the Internet, another problem-solving situation for you. Let's see here. From time to time, this is from Ken Woodward in B.C. From time to time up here in B.C., stillwater fishing key on hatching bomber Chironomus right at the surface.
Mm-hmm.
The fish can be madding difficult to hook when this happens. We'll attempt to dangle a pupa very close to the surface, use an emerger pattern, for example, Lady McConnell, or slowly retrieve a soft tackle pattern. Have you any suggestions on a more surefire way of fooling these fish? Sounds like he's having trouble hooking them up rather than getting them.
Yeah, I think when that hatch is going on, when I've seen that hatch all the way from New Mexico all the way up into Canada, and there's a very famous Canadian fly called the Tom Thumb that matches the adult, and I designed one called the Devil Bug, which matches the adult. You can just hang a pupil, a soft tackle pupil imitation out the back, and retrieve them over the surface. Most of the time when they take that thing, the take is really quite positive. And I don't know, maybe hesitating a little bit, or it's hard to say without actually seeing the fish, you know, doing things, what might be going on. But perhaps they're just, you know, they're really taking pupa, and you fish an adult, and they just sort of take a look at it or take a roll on it. But if you try fishing an adult with a pupa behind it, out there about 8 inches behind it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep.
What about that? I mean, when you're fishing dries out there, a lot of times it seems like you miss the strike, and many times you think, well, I tried too quickly to set the hook.
It might be too quickly, or it might be that when they got there and saw the thing, it wasn't exactly right, and they either didn't strike it or just rolled on it maybe. There's, like I say, without actually seeing the fish doing things, it's a little hard to tell. You know, a fish might move to, let's say during the bomber hatch or when the giant capering sedge, which is this giant caddisfly in the Western Lakes, when that thing's running over the surface, they will come and look at anything that's moving on the surface. You can throw a muddler minnow out there and they'll come and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But they may refuse it right at the last second because it's not exactly the right shape or exactly the right color. So, you know, I've caught them on humpies and all sorts of other things dragged over the surface. When you get a fly that's more the appropriate size with a green belly, you know, and a gray-colored back and all that kind of stuff, then there's much more chance of success than if you just cast a fly out there and drag it along.
So do you think, I mean, this is an argument we fly fishers have, you know, when we're missing those strikes, that, you know, some people will say, listen, these fish eat all day long. They don't make too many mistakes, so it must be the fly fisher that made the mistake. Or the other side of it is what you just said, which is they choose not to take it, but we think they took it, and it's not really our fault.
You know? Let's always put it that way.
Let's put it that way.
Not our fault.
But, you know, I mean, it's one of those catch-22. It's really hard to tell, I guess.
That's right.
Keep saying, you know.
And sometimes people do pull too fast, especially on bigger fish, because a bigger fish's mouth is bigger, and it takes a little bit longer for it to get it into its mouth and close its mouth and turn its head down. That's when you actually want to set the hook.
Yeah,
you know, in England, they say when a salmon strikes, you never strike back. You just let the salmon take the fly and roll down, and the line, the drag of the line is enough to get the hook going, and then once you feel the weight of the salmon, then you strike them. And I've caught Atlantic salmon, quite a few of them actually, over the years, and that's exactly what you do. You just wait till you feel the weight of the fish and then tighten up. You know, with trout, in England, they say, God save the queen. And, you know, here in the United States, we say, got you now, sucker, or something like that. You know?
A little less formal.
Yeah, a little less formal. And long enough for the fish to really get the fly in its mouth. Because you can actually pull the fly away from the fish.
We're, as humans, that fast? That's hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, they're fairly slow. I mean, I've had, just to prove it, let a fish take a fly and not do anything. And they'll swim around with the thing in their mouth for a while and all of a sudden feel the tension of the line and go zipping off.
Yeah. Okay, we've got, let's see, Brian in Clifton Park, New York. Please describe the best way to approach fish that are holding in difficult situations, cross complex currents, rocks between the fish, deep water, undercut banks, overhanging trees. The answer could include wading into position, casting type, leader design, use of flies, etc. I think he answered his own question.
It's all the above, yeah.
Yeah, you got to do all that stuff.
Okay, let's do this for just a second. There's tough situations are probably best approached by fishing downstream. Not always, but trees, you know, getting back underneath trees, a lot of times in rapids trying to fish around the edge of a rock or something like that, it's much easier to let the fly float naturally into the situation rather than trying to throw it up there into that situation somehow or other and get the line to perform the way you want it to perform. The problem is, when you're throwing onto complex currents, how do you mend the line to keep it from dragging the fly out of there? But if it's going downstream, it's pretty much mended all the time. Likewise, when I'm fishing, I rode in presentation in, about a fish that I'd fished in New Zealand that a friend of mine found, and he said, I've got you an impossible fish. You can't catch it. And I said, you can't. So he takes me to this place, and here's a fence going across the river, and right above the fence is a big tree that's fallen down, and there's a fish back underneath that tree just above the fence. Well, you obviously can't cast upstream to it, and that's the only way they ever thought about it. So I just went up around there, got upstream, floated the fly down, and caught him. So, you know, difficult situations. So we always think of fish and dry flies upstream, but don't. Think. Here's the way you want to think about it. Get the fly to the fish in such a way that the fish thinks the fly is something good to eat. Whether you fish down, up, or across, doesn't matter.
Right, right.
And the more casts and mends that you know, the better your opportunities for getting the fly there in a way that seems natural.
Brian also asked about the best way to avoid micro drag. I think you've answered that with the leader.
Yeah, the leader and mendings is what will do it for you. Yeah.
And then he also asked about furled leaders. Do you love them or hate them?
Well, furled leaders have some real advantages. They have some disadvantages, too. The real advantage of a furled leader is that it's softer than a single strand leader, and as a consequence will hold a smaller loop a little bit better. So you can also put about 8 pounds of fly floating in those babies, and they'll really sit up on top if you want them to. And they do tend to drop on the surface a little more softly, especially if they're furled leaders made from thread. Mono leaders are not as soft as the thread leaders are. Now, typically those thread leaders are going to give you much more ability to control drag because they're not going to cast as, you know, straight out like a mono leader will. They'll go out there and sort of drop in a puddle and fall on the surface. Back in the mid-60s, we were fishing thread tippets because we were getting drag and we were having problems trying to get the flies deep enough and that kind of stuff. And so, I mean, a thread tippet's probably about 1.5 pounds. And I don't recommend doing that necessarily, but furled leaders have their place, that's for sure. And a lot of guys are using furled leaders for tarpon and so on because they can end it in a loop, you know, on the end, and then you just loop on a whatever size class tippet you need with your shock tippet on the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
That works nicely.
Joe in New York asks, what about the upstream fishing of soft hackle spiders tied on light wire hooks in the film? How is that done? I can see how the lift and swing techniques work downstream, but I'm a little lost on the technique upstream.
Well, he might be interested to know that the upstream technique of dry fly fishing actually came out of the upstream technique for fishing wet flies. As spiders specifically, in 1857, a guy by the name of W.C. Stewart wrote a book called The Practical Angler, in which he described a new type of technique for fishing upstream with a relatively short line and a short rod. And by the way, a short rod meant, you know, 10 to 12 feet. Short guy. And a short line, 25 to 30 foot line, fishing up and across stream. And the reason he did that was he used very long soft hackles on his patterns, which he called spiders. And he thought they were actually imitations of aquatic arachnids, as he called them. Yes, aquatic spiders. And he would cast up and across stream and simply allow the currents to drift it along, lifting the rod to gather up the excess line and so on, and when the fly drifted through, he'd pick it back up and cast again. And we can still use that technique. It works very, very well. Basically, what you're doing is fishing it right underneath the surface film, and you can fish it on a greased leader, or you can fish it underneath an indicator or another fly if you want. But basically, what you're doing is the same as you would do with a dry fly up and across stream. So you want to use the Harvey-style leader, you want, you know, dry line, you want the greaser up so that it sits right up there, the leader sits right up there as high as you can, and then just cast up and watch it exactly like it was a dry fly. That's why using an indicator or a dry up on top is so handy, because you can see where it is, you can see if it's in the right food lane, you can tell if it's dragging or not dragging, and control all the things that are going on with it by watching the indicator or the dry fly.
Which leads us into a question here from Jeff Biller and Pennsylvania. He says, I was wondering if you could give a couple of tips on strike detection for fishing the film. Without the visual stimulation of a fish taking your dry fly off the top, how do you know when to set the hook? I guess he's talking about emergers if they haven't actually pulled on it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. Number one, if you're fishing flat waters, you can just use the greased leader tactic. That works very nicely. Just grease it up and watch the leader on the surface. It'll tell you everything that's going on. Otherwise, I put an indicator on, or like I say, I use two flies. There are times when I don't use two flies, especially if I've got a lot of weed or something and I'm afraid the second fly might get caught up in the weeds or something, but then I just use a small indicator. And I don't use a big indicator. You know, people have gone to larger and larger and larger indicators, and that might be all right for certain things. But when I'm fishing, you know, let's say a size 16 midge pupa or size 16 caddis pupa underneath the surface film down there about 4 inches, I would make the indicator, and I'd use a piece of yarn, just knot, tie an overhand knot in the tippet, slide the yarn through, pull it tight, and then make it about the same size as the pupa, grease it up with fly floating so it looks like a little dry fly, and cast her out there. Sometimes they'll take the indicator. If they do, just pull the hook through and stick them on the other side of the mouth.
Yeah. <I'll look>
Hey, if they catch my line, you're in trouble, baby.
Okay, Kurt in Utah asks, I'm often stumped on dead, calm, still water with rising fish. I believe the common thread is a midge hatch. I've tried 18 to 22 pupas, emerges in adults. I get an occasional fish on the adult, but considering the amount of activity, it's obvious they are feeding on something else. Do you have a pattern in size and retrieve suggestions? So,
well, you know, midges can be really frustrating in still waters. And there's a couple of things that go on. Number one, the pupa will rise to the surface and sink back down again, rise to the surface and sink back down again, rise to the surface and sink back down again, maybe 4 or 5 times before it finally gets its back stuck into the surface film and emergence begins. So sometimes what I'll do is just stick an indicator on about 3 feet up from the fly and cast out and wait maybe 5 seconds or so for the thing to sink and then pull it so I can just see a V that the indicator's making. Just make a V. That pulls the fly back up to the surface, and I wait a few seconds and let it sink back down again, and then pull it again. A lot of times that's the trick, because what they're doing is they're grabbing these pupa as they're getting up near the surface, and they aren't really taking, as we've discussed earlier, really taking things out of the film or on top of the film. The other thing is, of course, they may be taking emergers, and if that's the case, then I would use an emerger style, like a Griffith's net, trim top and bottom, or a small parachute style, maybe with a little ball on top. But you know, then you just have to sort of watch what's going on. Now, retrieve styles, in still waters, you can just cast and let it sit out there, or you can strip it. And I've had some luck sometimes just casting and stripping the thing back fairly fast. And I don't know why they would take that when they're taking pupa that are just hanging there, other than it just excites them.
They see the movement and trigger something,
yep.
Well, I was always wondering about that. Again, fishing this little lake down here of mine, you know, I get to fish it quite often, so you know, you get to experiment more, but I've always wondered that, if you throw a nice cast out there and you've got a dry fly and a pupa under the water, what's the determination of how long you let it sit? I mean, because you're basing it on cruising trout, right?
Yeah.
So when does that movement really come into play, or is it necessary? I mean,
if you know you've got fish in the area and you've seen fish rising, I would just throw it and let it sit. And then if I don't get anything, you know, any rises or takes or anything after a couple of minutes, and I mean a couple of minutes, not like 14 seconds, and I might, you know, I might jiggle the fly a little bit, just shake the rod tip back and forth a little bit so that the dry fly moves. And then I might wait a little while off that, and if nothing happens, I might actually strip it a foot or two and then let it sit. And the reason you do that is not because it looks like an insect, but because, let's say there's a fish over there 8 feet away and he's cruising along, and all of a sudden he sees this thing move on the surface. He'll look at it and come over to see what it is. And then when he sees the pupa hanging there or the adult on top, he'll take it. Mm-hmm. Lots of times I've been fishing cruisers and casting in front of them and had them, you know, when they get a little bit close, just move it a tiny bit, and boy, they just bang and instantly take it. So I think that a little bit of movement occasionally, it's like calling ducks. If you just keep quacking and quacking and quacking, they fly away. But if you give a couple little calls and wait a little bit and then give a little chuckle and wait a little bit and another call, they're much more likely to come to it. And I think the same thing happens with flies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're always thinking, well, if I pull it up and recast, you know, 5 feet to the right, the fish may have just swam back to where you were just at.
That's right.
You know?
Absolutely.
You know, if you don't know what direction they're going, it's really, you know, a gamble.
Yeah. If you got a weed edge, it's like a submerged weed edge, I'd fish that fly right on that weed edge and just let it hang there. Because if there are fish cruising around, they'll find it. If they can see a size 22 midge pupa, you know, they'll find your fly.
Yeah. So sounds like patience is...
Patience is really required, especially for stillwater fishing. And a lot of people don't like the stillwater fish because they want to be in the river moving and casting, you know,
right,
and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But there are bigger fish and more fish in stillwaters.
Yeah. Okay, we're running out of time here. Let's see what we can get done here. Ryan and Reno again. Does a scud hook or straight hook give better presentation when fishing emergers in the film? Seems like the scud hook allows the body to hang down more in the film.
Yeah, really either one. You know, I've tied flies on both hooks, and if you look at like the clinkhammer, it's tied on a more of a scud shape kind of fly, and if you look at a, you know, a parachute Adams, it's just tied in a straight hook, and they both work just fine. I don't really think it's necessarily that one works better than the other. I think it's just that we, as individual anglers, have an eye for one or the other, and we like it better. And really, you should be confident in the flies you fish.
Here's an interesting question to end the evening on. Chris in Idaho, formerly Wisconsin, so he just wants to he wants to have that little connection with you there.
I guess. Here's some ice for you.
Yeah, these and all these Wisconsin folks are going to be rather loud on Sunday, aren't they?
They are. Right, when we win.
When you win. He says, you and I go back a spell in the evolution of fly patterns for trout in America, and you've developed some great ones on your own. What patterns developed in the last decade would you say are groundbreaking, rather than merely tweaked patterns of Swisher / Richards, LaFontaine, and yourself?
Oh, that's a tough one. Groundbreaking stuff. I think more than anything, the groundbreaking patterns are developing in salt and in warm water tropical and in warm water freshwater stuff in the temperate zone. You know, I mean, I think there's some good stuff happening in terms of dry flies and pupa and so on. But most of these newer things that we see coming haven't really changed style so much as they've changed the use of some materials, like CDC and, you know, Antron, and beads and a few other things that we see happening in, but in the world of fishing for pike and bass and tropical fish like piata and dorado and tigerfish, we see some amazing stuff coming there. And the development of some really, really interesting patterns and really interesting uses, which, of course, will eventually slop over into trout fishing, too.
Mm-hmm. I think that's been something we've seen over the past decade or so, as a rise is in general just warm water fishing.
Oh yeah.
Fly fishing that we had.
Much more of it.
Yeah.
Especially as people go into tropical venues. You know, bass fishing has always been around, but all of a sudden now we got people looking at things like tiger fish and piara and peacock bass and these big
Dorado.
Dorado and that kind of stuff. You just see lots of that going on.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, a lot of people going to Central and South America to get those arowanas.
Oh yeah.
I always loved the arowana. I had one in my fish tank when I was a kid, you know.
Those buggers get big. They get huge.
I think those would be excellent on a dry fly.
It'd be a big dry fly.
Yeah, it'd have to be a big one. Yep. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time here, Gary, but stick with me here because we're going to give away your book here in a few minutes. And we'll also be giving away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So stick around. You might win Gary Borger's new book, Fishing the Film, and we'll be right back. Family Ties, and that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link, leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away a prize. So the winners for the drawings are randomly selected from our registration database, and if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but you want to make sure you do it for the next show because never know, you might be a winner. So if you are a winner, we will contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gift. And so for the drawing tonight, the first thing we're going to draw for is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you'd like to learn more about them, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And you can learn about the organization, a great organization to support. And they are international, both salt, warm, and fresh water, so no matter where you live. For instance, if you live in Florida, like John Frazier does, or Frazier, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, then you could use a membership down there. So, John, you just won a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So congratulations. And now we'll draw for that one-year subscription to the Fly Fusion magazine. Again, a great magazine to support. If you want to learn about getting a subscription there, you can go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner for that is subscription is Andrew Borien. Andrew Borien, and he lives in Virginia. So congratulations, Andrew, on winning that one-year subscription. So in either of these cases, if you already have a subscription or membership, we'll get that extended for you and make it last a bit longer for you. Okay, now, Gary, we've got to give your book away. Fishing the Film by Gary Borger, one of the first of many to come. And, boy, you're going to be lucky tonight if you win this. So a really nice gift to be getting tonight. So let me clear my cue here. And one of the things Gary talked about that was very important, and he talked about that this was probably the most important thing, was drag. Drag was, you know, of utmost importance. Get rid of the drag and you're going to catch more fish. There was a leader developed by a man that helped counteract drag. What was the name of that man that he talked very often about in tonight's show? So... Let's see here. I think this guy's got it here. Let me read his answer to you, Gary, and then you determine. He says, Harvey style, longer, thinner, limber, gets lots of curvy tippet.
That's good.
That's good?
Yeah.
Hey,
good.
Warren Davis, you just won Gary's book. Good job. And you've already sent me your information here, so I'll pass that on to Gary, and Gary will send that directly to you from warm Wisconsin. Home of the future Super Bowl winners.
That's correct.
Well, great. Terrific, terrific. Well, congratulations, Warren. He was the first one in there and got it right away. So we want to thank him for that. Okay. Well, that about does it for tonight, Gary. I want to thank you for being on the show again with us. And
thank you, Roger.
It was a big hit, and this one will be too, I know. And so were your book, Fishing the Film. So good luck with that series. I look forward to seeing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we will have our next broadcast on February 16th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Denny Rickards. And our topic for the show will be stillwater presentations. So Denny Rickards is one of the great masters of stillwater fly fishing. And on this show, Denny covers trout behavior, the impact of weather conditions on trout and their food sources, using the correct line, pattern, retrieve, and that matches the zone you are fishing, and positioning to make the right cast, and much more. So join us for that show. I know you'll enjoy it. So we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Heaney's Fly Shop, as well as our other sponsors for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you would like to sponsor our show in the future, just call us at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.